Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
All the way back to 2008. Ruination, the early years.
Imagine a broadcaster, right? He's looking at a Category 4 hurricane.
Oh, a massive storm.
Yeah, just barreling toward the coast. And instead of giving you, you know, the barometric pressure or local evacuation routes, he pulls up a map and tells you which of his friends' podcast studios the storm is going to hit first.
Right. No weather alerts at all.
None. No warnings from the National Hurricane Center. Just a tour map of podcasters. Like, the hurricane was, I don't know, a rock band playing a series of house shows across the Southeast.
It's just such a perfect distillation of how people were using this new medium back then. I mean, when you don't have traditional broadcasting rules, you start bending global events to fit the scale of your own digital neighborhood.
Exactly.
The hurricane isn't a meteorological event anymore. It's just a narrative device for your audio journal.
Welcome, everyone. I am King, and we are stepping into the archives today for a deep dive into the source material for Ruination, the early years.
And I am Gail, and we're so glad you're joining us.
Our mission today is to extract the most fascinating, chaotic, and honestly perplexing nuggets from a really pivotal week in the life and stories of the Big Fatty online podcast universe.
We are entirely bypassing the algorithmically polished feeds of today.
Uh-huh.
You know, we're taking you back to the raw, completely unedited audio reality of mid-August 2008.
And to really understand the psychological framework that we're unpacking for you today, we need to briefly ground you in what this archive actually represents.
Right. Context is everything here.
Yeah.
So Big Fatty Online, which is often just abbreviated as BFO, is a daily, precisely 20-minute audio journal.
20 minutes on the dot.
Usually, yes. Mm-hmm. And it launched on February 3rd, 2008. Now, if you check your historical calendars, you'll see that was Super Bowl Sunday.
Oh, but we can't call it that.
No, we absolutely can't. Because early podcasters were famously terrified of the NFL's aggressive trademark enforcement.
They were convinced they'd get sued into oblivion.
Totally. So the host referred to it as the Booper Soul, or the Superb Owl, halftime. It's hosted by a man named Big Fatty from his home studio, which he affectionately dubbed the Fat Cave.
Which is located in a North Charleston, South Carolina neighborhood that he calls Fat Acres.
Right. And his overarching philosophy, the absolute bedrock of this entire operation, is encapsulated in his daily catchphrase.
Oh, you have to say the catchphrase.
It is, quote, "It's not just ruined, it's me, Big Fatty Online."
Yes. And that word, ruined, that is his license to be completely imperfect.
It really is.
It sets the expectation for you, the listener, that things are going to go off the rails, technology is going to fail, and he is going to complain about it loudly.
Very loudly.
So we are zeroing in on an incredibly dense stretch of time here. We're looking at episodes 142 through 146, which originally aired from August 18th through the 22nd of 2008.
It's quite a week.
It is. And what's wild to me about reading through these transcripts is how he builds trust with his audience, not through expertise, but through sheer agonizing domestic frustration.
He really anchors the listener in the mundane. I mean, episode 142 drops on Monday, August 18th, and he doesn't open with anything glamorous.
None at all.
He starts with the tactile sensory comfort of baking what he calls big fat yeast rolls.
Which honestly sounded pretty good.
They did. But then he pivots immediately into this epic saga about purchasing and setting up an Apple AirPort Extreme router over the weekend.
Oh man, the router saga.
But see, he doesn't just mention the router in passing. He completely weaponizes the financial math of the purchase to prove that he lives in the exact same economic reality as his audience.
You know, reading this, the sheer amount of time he spends on the math caught me off guard. Like, he explains exactly how he utilized a birthday gift card, which he refers to as a Circe, by the way.
Right, a Circe.
Yeah, and for anyone outside the American South, a Circe is just a colloquialism for a small, unexpected gift or surprise.
It's a great word.
It is. So he takes this Circe and he walks you through his exact coupon logic. And I want you to explain why this specific breakdown matters so much, because he gets down to the literal dollars and cents.
It matters heavily because of the socioeconomic context of 2008.
Right, the financial crisis.
Exactly. We are in the thick of a global financial meltdown, and he's navigating what is essentially a luxury tech purchase.
Yeah.
So he explains that he originally wanted the Apple AirPort Express, which was priced at $99.
$100, basically.
Right. But he noticed the upgraded model, the Airport Extreme, had a $20 discount, bringing its retail price down to $159.
Okay, follow the math here, folks.
He then mentally applies his $50 gift card to that discounted price, bringing his out-of-pocket cost to roughly $109.
Which is brilliant logic, honestly.
He justifies this to the audience by pointing out that for just $10 more than the base model, he gets a significantly wider wireless range for the Fat Cave.
It's the ultimate justification. He literally says, "We love a coupon, y'all. If you know nothing else about Big Fatty, you know he loves a coupon."
He is performing the mental gymnastics we all do when we want the better gadget, but we need to appease our own financial guilt.
Totally. But then, after all that brilliant economic strategy, he gets the hardware home, and he is completely defeated by it.
Utterly defeated.
He can't get it to work at all. He has to call in a longtime friend and former co-host, Mr. Larry H. Vader, to provide remote technical support on a Sunday afternoon just to get a basic internet connection going.
I think we really have to look at the psychological mechanism at play here. Why would you broadcast your own technological incompetence?
Yeah, why admit that?
Because in the early days of podcasting, the hosts were usually the tech-savvy early adopters, right? They were the ones who knew how to hand code an RSS feed.
They were nerds. I mean that affectionately, but they were tech nerds.
Exactly. So by freely admitting he had to call his friend Larry to fix his router, Big Fatty strips away that intimidating veneer of the broadcaster.
He levels the playing field.
He isn't an elite hacker. He's your exasperated neighbor fighting with a blinking plastic box.
Mm.
It creates an incredibly powerful parasocial bond because the listener feels maybe a bit superior in their technical knowledge, but deeply empathetic to his frustration.
I see where you're going with that, but I actually think it goes a little bit deeper than just empathy.
Oh, how so?
Think about the modern internet ecosystem. Specifically, think about the YouTube unboxing video.
Okay, yeah.
You watch these influencers unbox the newest iPhone, and it is so heavily produced. It's bathed in ring lights. It's completely sterile.
It's an aesthetic.
Exactly. It's about acquiring a status symbol. What Big Fatty is doing with his router saga is basically the 2008 audio equivalent of an unboxing video, but completely stripped of all corporate gloss.
That's a great point.
He isn't unboxing a status symbol. He's unboxing the desperate human need to just get the baseline infrastructure of your life to function.
That is an excellent distinction.
Yeah.
He is performing the friction of daily life.
Yeah.
And he extends that exact same domestic friction into his grocery shopping, too.
Oh, with cereal.
Yes. He details buying a box of cinnamon streusel mini wheats from local Publix because, of course, they were on sale.
Obviously.
He promises his audience a full review of the cereal, but then he sets this incredibly rigid boundary. Absolutely refuses to eat the cereal while recording.
Which is so funny to me.
He explicitly calls out other podcasters who chew in the ears of their listeners, drawing this hard line on audio etiquette.
Which is just such a bizarre place to draw a line.
Right.
Because, I mean, if you listen to the broader archive, this is a man who will freely and enthusiastically broadcast the most intimate, humiliating details about his gastrointestinal distress.
He holds nothing back.
Nothing. He talks about his vacation poop. He talks about his debilitating taco salad gas. He has zero personal boundaries. But the sound of chewing cereal, that is a bridge too far.
It reveals a very specific hierarchy of respect for the medium, I think.
How do you mean?
Well, he views his bodily functions as narrative content, right? It's a way to entertain and shock the listener. But he views the sound of chewing directly into a microphone as an acoustic violation.
Ah, I see.
It shows that despite his casual, chaotic persona, he is actually thinking deeply about the auditory experience of the person wearing the headphones.
Okay, so he finally gets this Apple router working, thanks to Larry H. Vader. He has his internet connection. But what fascinates me is what he does with that connection.
He gets busy.
Very busy. He doesn't just passively consume the internet. He uses his newly acquired bandwidth to actively manipulate his community. He essentially starts playing God with his podcast network, building this incredibly complicated web of interaction.
We see the mechanics of this community building really take off in episode 143, which is from Tuesday, August 19th. And it starts not with a digital interaction, but with physical mail.
Tangible stuff.
Exactly. He treats physical mail as tangible proof of his reach in a digital world. He opens a birthday hoot nanny package sent by a listener he calls Bill in St. Louis.
And the contents of that package, oh man, they are like a time capsule.
Truly.
It is the 2008 Dameron Men's Travel Guide. Now, for listeners who might not be familiar with queer history before the era of smartphones and apps like Grindr, the Dameron Guide was essential.
It was a lifeline.
It was. It was the definitive physical directory listing gay bed and breakfast bars and cruising areas across the entire country.
Right.
And Big Fatty is thrilled to get a fresh copy, joking that he's going to have to physically fight his friend Larry Cly for it before their upcoming trip to the New Yorks.
It is a remarkable artifact to receive in the mail.
Hmm.
I mean, Bob Dameron started publishing those guys in the 1960s as a literal survival tool to help gay men find safe spaces while traveling.
Yes, safety was a huge issue.
Absolutely. By 2008, the internet was starting to make physical directories obsolete, but Big Fatty still heavily values the tactile book.
It's a piece of history.
It is. It bridges the historical, physical, queer community with his newly forming digital, borderless podcast community. Mm. But as you mentioned earlier, he doesn't just rely on physical books. He launches a massive digital cross-promotional event that he officially dubs, Guess What's on Big Fatty's Inappropriate Touch.
This contest is a logistical nightmare by today's standards, and I love it so much.
It's so convoluted.
So he buys a brand new Apple iPod Touch, immediately renames it the Inappropriate Touch, and loads it with music. He decides to make a game out of having listeners guess what songs he put on it.
Sounds simple enough.
But no, he intentionally introduces massive friction into the process. You can't just call his BFO voicemail line or leave a comment on his blog.
Right, he forces his audience into this insane multi-step scavenger hunt.
Tell him the steps, because it's wild.
Okay, to participate, you have to go to the Big Fatty online website, find a specific link, and click over the website of his friend and podcasting rival, Larry Clyde,
who hosts a show called LK Today.
Exactly. You then have to pick up your actual phone, call Larry Clyde's Seattle-based voicemail number, which was 206-426-6914, and leave your guess on a totally different show's machine.
I just want to pause and appreciate the sheer effort required to play a podcast game in 2008.
It was a commitment.
You are actively routing your audience away from your own platform to boost someone else's. And then Larry Clyde takes those voicemails, like a listener named Walt calling in and guessing the songs Afternoon Delight and Muskrat Love, and Larry plays them on his episode of LK Today.
Right.
Then Big Fatty downloads Larry's episode, extracts the audio of Walt's voicemail, and plays it back on the BFO. It is an audio snake eating its own tail.
He calls this the incestuous web of the RNL podcasting network. And, you know, from a media studies perspective, what he is doing is incredibly sophisticated.
How so?
Well, in 2008, Apple Podcasts did not have algorithms to automatically recommend similar shows. There was no listeners who subscribed to BFO also liked LK Today feature.
Oh, right. Discoverability was terrible back then.
It was entirely manual. So Big Fatty coded a human algorithm. He weaponized his own listeners' desire to participate in a contest, physically forcing them to navigate and engage with a peer's show.
It's brilliant. If we look at modern influencer collaborations on TikTok, right, where creators duet each other's videos to share audiences or big YouTube crossover events, Big Fatty was doing this manually 15 years earlier.
He absolutely was.
He was crowdsourcing audience sharing before it had a name.
He's controlling this digital ecosystem manually, forcing his audience into this cross-pollination game. He's acting as the architect of his own reality.
Yeah.
But it's fascinating because while he is playing God with his podcast network, there is a literal act of God Hurricane Faye barreling toward the southeast coast that he cannot control.
And how he handles that lack of control tells us everything about his worldview.
It really does.
He filters a massive, destructive national news event entirely through his own hyperinsular lens. As we mentioned earlier, he looks at the radar for Hurricane Faye, and instead of seeing a meteorological threat, he decides the hurricane is just taking a podcasting tour of the southeast.
Just a little road trip.
Right. He traces the exact routing. He says the storm is going to hit Tampa, which he specifically identifies as the home of the Pod Is My Co-Pilot podcast.
Okay.
Then it will cross over to Lakeland to hit the Foul Monkeys. From there, it moves to Orlando, hitting the QCast crew. Then it travels up the coast to South Kakalaki, which is his term for Charleston, hitting his own BFO headquarters.
Naturally.
It pushes inland to Columbia to hit Dubious Intent, flares up in Atlanta to strike Peter Potamus, and finally, he predicts it will just peter out by the time it reaches the Virginia Vaginas.
We really need to unpack the psychological mechanism of substituting a parasocial network for an actual geographic map.
Why does he do it?
When a natural disaster approaches, the human brain desperately seeks ways to process the overwhelming scale of the threat. Traditional news amplifies the fear with red graphics and dire warnings.
Yeah, they want you panicked.
By mapping the hurricane using only the locations of his friends' podcast studios, Big Fatty shrinks the terrifying scale of the event. He turns an uncontrollable force of nature into an interactive, manageable inside joke.
He's domesticating the hurricane.
Exactly. He's domesticating the hurricane.
It's like he was treating a Category 4 storm like a band on tour. He's not looking at the projected property damage. He's just checking the tour dates to see when the storm will be playing a set at his friends' houses.
It's a coping mechanism.
And he even equalizes the weather event with a listener's road trip.
Oh, Brian.
Yes. He notes that Brian from Boston is driving from Chicago down to Atlanta and eventually to Charleston. He hilariously notes that Brian is bringing, quote, Viagra to Niagara.
Which is quite the tagline.
He gives a guy driving a sedan the exact same narrative weight as a tropical cyclone.
It creates a reality distortion bubble. Inside that bubble, you are perfectly safe, surrounded by people who understand your inside jokes, and the real world only matters when it intersects with your audio feed.
But outside the bubble.
Outside the bubble, the wind is quite literally ripping the roof off the house. He is prioritizing the community narrative over objective reality.
And speaking of prioritizing a personal narrative over objective reality, I think it's time we open the vault.
Oh boy, here we go.
Because when you live inside a reality distortion bubble, eventually facts are going to try to pierce that bubble. And Big Fatty does not handle that well.
No, he does not.
It is time for us to engage in our mandatory accountability segment. Let's officially open the floor to Ruined Ruination.
Ruined Ruination is the space in our deep dive dedicated to correcting the factual errors, the stubborn inaccuracies, and the historical injustices found buried within the BFO archive.
Because while Big Fatty demands authenticity from himself and his audience, he has a highly contentious relationship with being told he is factually wrong.
I would say highly contentious is an understatement. Mm-hmm. Let's pull the first file. Archive Correction 1. The Ryan Starr Jones iTunes Saga.
Oh, poor Ryan.
This is a prime example of externalizing blame. Big Fatty spent a significant amount of airtime aggressively blaming a dedicated listener, Ryan Starr Jones, for podcast download failures.
He really went after him.
He publicly reprimanded Ryan, insisted Ryan's computer was broken, and literally demanded that Ryan perform random acts of kindness as penance for daring to suggest the BFO feed was broken.
He put his own listener on trial, like a digital kangaroo court.
But the objective truth eventually surfaced. It turned out the entire issue was a massive global software glitch tied to Apple iTunes version 7.7.1.
Which was completely out of Ryan's control.
Entirely. To give some technical context to why this was such a big deal, July 2008 was the launch of the iPhone 3G in the App Store.
Oh, right. A huge transition for Apple.
Apple was completely overhauling iTunes to handle mobile applications, and in the process, they broke the RSS feed syncing mechanism that independent podcasters relied on. It was a monumental technical headache cascading down from a multi-billion dollar corporation, resulting in broken downloads worldwide.
So it was undeniably Apple's fault, not Ryan's.
Exactly.
But here is the true ruination of the situation. Big Fatty never, and I mean never, formally apologized to Ryan Starr Jones.
No apology at all.
He quietly mentioned the iTunes bug later, but he never retracted his demand for penance. He just moved on, leaving this unjust punishment hanging in the digital air. He refused to admit that his initial diagnosis was completely embarrassingly wrong.
Which leads us directly into Archive Correction 2, the American Idol denial.
This one is just wild to me.
Big Fatty spent an entire season of the reality show loudly and stubbornly predicting that David Archuleta would win the competition. He invested significant airtime into this prediction.
He was sure of it.
Very sure. But when the finale aired and David Cook actually won the popular vote, objective reality clashed with Big Fatty's aesthetic preference.
And how did he handle it? Did he accept the voting results of millions of Americans? Absolutely not.
Not even a little bit.
He flatly refused to concede defeat. He simply stated on his podcast that Archuleta was cuter.
That was his entire defense.
He substituted a factual, mathematically verifiable outcome with his own subjective aesthetic judgment, declaring himself the winner of the argument anyway.
It is a fascinating display of cognitive dissonance. And we see that exact same defiance applied to corporate branding in Archive Correction 3, the pronunciation defiance.
Oh, this is the movie one.
Yes. In the summer of 2008, Pixar released the critically acclaimed, heavily marketed animated film, WALL-E.
Qually, right.
Despite massive pop culture saturation and millions of dollars in advertising telling the public how to say the name, Big Fatty displayed an absolute unyielding refusal to pronounce it correctly.
Wait, how do you say it?
He stubbornly insisted on calling it Wally, making it rhyme with Sally.
Wally like Sally.
Yeah.
He just fundamentally rejected the branding. It's such a petty hill to die on, but he plants his flag and refuses to move.
And finally, we have Archives Correction 4, the naming error. This one is perhaps the most socially awkward of them all.
Brace yourselves for this one.
Big Fatty spent an entire weekend socializing in person with a listener named Will. And inexplicably, he called Will Scott for the entire weekend.
To his face.
To his face. When Will later politely called into the BFO voicemail line to gently correct the host on his actual legal name, Big Fatty absorbed the correction without an ounce of contrition.
He didn't even say sorry.
There was no profuse apology. It was essentially, oh, well, moving on.
We really have to analyze the psychology behind what we can call the fat cave reality distortion field.
We do.
Because we established earlier that he has zero personal boundaries. He will freely broadcast details about his bodily functions that most people would take to their graves.
Gladly broadcast them.
Right. Why does a man who is so obsessively radically honest about his biological embarrassments completely refuse to admit when he is factually wrong about a software bug or a reality TV winner or a friend's literal name?
You might think this makes him a terrible host. I mean, on paper, refusing to apologize, getting your friends' names wrong, and denying reality sounds like a recipe for driving an audience away.
Yeah, it really does. But I actually argue the exact opposite.
Really?
Hear me out. In the context of this specific audio universe, this unapologetic stubbornness is the very mechanism that increases audience loyalty.
How do you figure that? If someone called me the wrong name for a weekend and didn't apologize, I would feel alienated, not loyal.
Sure, but you are looking at it through the lens of polite societal norms. You need to look at it through the lens of professional wrestling.
Wrestling.
Yeah. This is a classic pro wrestling heel move.
Mm-hmm.
When the bad guy in the ring refuses to follow the rules, when he arrogantly struts around denying reality, even as the referee is counting him out, the audience boos him, but they secretly love it.
They
love the arrogance because it makes the character impenetrable. Big Fatty is playing the heel with objective reality itself.
That's a really interesting way to frame it.
He will humiliate his own body for a laugh, proving he's human, but he will never, ever let Apple or Pixar or even a listener tell him he's intellectually wrong. It makes him seem invincible to the establishment.
I hadn't considered the pro wrestling angle, but it fits perfectly. The vulnerability he offers is strictly biological. The ego he projects is entirely bulletproof.
Exactly.
He controls exactly what kind of ruination he allows into the narrative. If his stomach acts up, that is acceptable ruination. If his podcast prediction is wrong, that is unacceptable, and the reality must be rejected entirely.
He is the sole author of the facts within the fat cave. But let's leave the unyielding stubbornness of his past behind us and look at how Big Fatty prepares for his future.
Let's do that.
Because as we move into the end of the week, the scope of his life begins to rapidly expand beyond his home studio. We are moving into the culmination of our week, focusing on episodes 144 through 146, which aired August 20th through the 22nd.
This stretch of episodes provides a really sharp contrast between his daily grind and his expansive personal life.
Yeah. Quite a shift.
We get an incredible milestone conversation in episode 144. A caller named Jeremiah, checking in from Temple Beth Israel, mentions attending a 104th birthday party.
104, wow.
Right. Big Fatty immediately jumps on the math, clarifying that he is exactly half that age, 52 years old. But then he uses his age to drop a massive monumental countdown on the audience.
The big reveal.
He announces that as of August 20th, he's exactly 21 days away from being able to retire from what he calls the coal mine.
The coal mine is such a deeply evocative, bleak nickname for his 40-year career at a corporate day job. You can just hear the exhaustion in his voice when he talks about it.
It really weighs on him.
It does. But we do need to acknowledge a significant archival discrepancy here for the sake of historical accuracy.
Yes, the dates don't line up.
Official BFO fact sheets in later episodes confirm that he actually retired from his job on June 30th, 2018.
A full 10 years later.
Right. So this 21-day countdown he's celebrating in August of 2008 was highly likely an eligibility milestone regarding a pension or maybe a specific tier of benefits, not his actual final day of employment.
That discrepancy is actually quite telling.
Mm-hmm.
If he was still 10 years away from actual retirement, what did that 21-day countdown represent psychologically?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It was the light at the end of the tunnel, even if the tunnel was still a decade long. It was a desperate coping mechanism to get through the daily grind.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But what is truly remarkable is how he immediately collides that heavy, long-term career milestone with the immediate, absurd logistics of his theatrical hobbies.
He transitions without taking a breath right into giving the audience updates on his local community theater rehearsal.
It's a sudden pivot.
He is involved in a play called The Buxy Blues, but the detail he chooses to share with his listeners isn't about the emotional core of the play or learning lines or character motivation.
No, it's purely obsessively logistical.
Yes. He spends valuable airtime detailing the absolute nightmare of hauling physical bunk beds up a flight of stairs to the rehearsal hall.
Just hauling furniture.
He explains that he made the actors physically maneuver in the bunk beds during rehearsal so they would realize how incredibly difficult it is to act while sitting cross-legged on a top bunk.
He says, quote, "It's the little things that you don't expect to be a problem that'll give you a problem."
He is a taskmaster for theatrical realism. He wants his actors to suffer the reality of the furniture.
It's hilarious.
But that obsessive attention to physical logistics sets up the most jarring juxtaposition of the entire week.
Oh, here we go.
The moment that truly defines the chaotic BFO aesthetic arrives as he discusses his impending weekend travel plans. He is preparing to leave Charleston for a trip to what he calls the Horror Hotel.
The Horror Hotel is his affectionate, slightly ominous nickname for the Metropolis Entertainment Complex located in Augusta, Georgia.
Augusta, Georgia.
He is heading there for a highly specific, explicit leather club event with his core group of friends. And the specific internal debate he chooses to broadcast to thousands of listeners is staggering in its casually explicit nature.
It really is. He is openly debating the complex logistics of whether or not it is too much of a physical hassle to pack the sling for a short two-night trip.
For context, for those who might not know, he is methodically weighing the effort of disassembling, packing, and reassembling heavy, explicit sexual equipment just for a weekend getaway. And he's treating it with the exact same logistical concern as packing a toothbrush or an extra pair of shoes.
He literally tells the audience, "I hear people unsubscribing even as they hear this, because what? Big fatty go to the Horror Hotel and not take the sling. It's blasphemy, y'all."
He elevates the packing of sex furniture to a matter of religious doctrine.
He knows it's shocking. He knows it might cost him listeners, but he simply does not care.
If we synthesize all the material from this week, we have to look at the extreme juxtaposition he embodies.
It's a lot to take in.
It is. In one single breath, in one uninterrupted audio file, he presents himself as a 52-year-old man complaining about hauling bunk beds for a quaint community theater play, celebrating a pension eligibility date from a soul-crushing corporate job, and then casually disdaining the transportation of a leather sling across state lines for an explicit weekend party.
It gives you absolute whiplash. You are bouncing from Betty Crocker domesticity to corporate depression to underground leather clubs in the span of 20 minutes.
It's dizzying.
But I think we have to extrapolate what this actually means for the medium of podcasting as a whole, because this total lack of compartmentalization is the true hidden secret to the BFO's astonishing longevity.
You think so?
Absolutely. This show has run for over 16 years, which is practically centuries in internet time.
How do you connect the lack of compartmentalization to longevity? Most conventional wisdom says you need a very focused niche to survive in media.
Because maintaining a niche is exhausting. Most content creators today suffer from intense burnout.
Oh, definitely.
They are constantly trying to maintain a curated work self to appease the algorithm, a family self for their relatives, and a separate weekend self for their real lives. Mm. Keeping those masks on takes an immense amount of psychological energy.
That's very true.
Big Fatty doesn't have masks. He doesn't compartmentalize. He takes the entire messy, contradictory, glorious tapestry of his life. The $20 coupons, the hurricane tracking, the bunk beds, the slings, the taco salad gas, the pro wrestling denial of reality.
Full pile.
Yes. And he just dumps the whole unfiltered pile into the microphone. He never runs out of content because he refuses to hide any part of his human existence.
He demands that the audience accept the totality of his human experience.
Yeah.
He isn't curating a brand. He is documenting a life completely unapologetically.
Yeah.
If you don't like the leather club talk, Well, you have to sit through it to get to the coupon math.
Yeah.
It forces the listener to accept him as a complete three-dimensional person, not just a digital avatar.
And that brings us to the final synthesis of this incredible deep dive. We have traveled through the unimaginable breadth of the mid-August 2008 BFO experience.
It's been a journey.
We've seen how a single microphone in a spare bedroom in South Carolina became the anchor for a global community.
We have explored a digital world where tracking the devastating path of a hurricane is treated as indistinguishable from checking the geographic locations of your podcasting friends.
Yep.
We've seen a world where massive global Apple iTunes software bugs are completely ignored in favor of demanding moral penance from a single innocent listener.
And we have witnessed a universe where the decision to pack a leather sling for a weekend in Augusta is treated with the exact same narrative weight, the exact same logistical gravity, as clipping a grocery store coupon for a wireless router.
It really is a masterpiece of leveled priorities.
Everything matters, and therefore, nothing is too sacred to be ruined.
It forces us to reconsider what we value as an audience and what we consider worthy of broadcasting. It challenges the modern obsession with a polished, curated aesthetic.
So as we wrap up this journey into the archives, I want to leave you, the listener, with a deep, standalone question to mull over.
Think about this one.
Think about this while you are driving to work, or while you're folding your laundry, or while you are fighting with your own internet router. In our modern era, we spend so much of our precious energy curating a flawless, highly compartmentalized digital identity.
We really do.
We hide our messes. We use ring lights and filters and carefully constructed professional bios to convince the world that we have everything under control. But Big Fatty built a global, fiercely loyal community, not by being perfect, but by absolutely refusing to hide his stubbornness, refusing to hide his mundane financial anxieties, and brazenly refusing to hide his highly explicit weekends.
So true.
So ask yourself, what specific, unpolished, perhaps deeply embarrassing detail of your own life are you currently hiding away, terrified that people might judge you for it?
What are you holding back?
What if that messy, ruined part of you might actually be the very thing needed to build a genuine, unbreakable connection with someone else? Are you hiding the exact thing that makes you real?
It is a terrifying proposition to drop the mask and offer the ruination to the world. But as this archive proves, it is ultimately a very liberating way to live.
It really is. Thank you all so much for joining us on this incredible exploration of the audio archives. We've only just scratched the surface of the Fat Cave. Be sure to tune in next weekend for the newest episode of Ruination, The Early Years. I'm Kim.
And I'm Gail.
And we will see you back in the archives next time.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination, The Early Years. Join us again next weekend. We'll see you then.